You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Decibel Geek Podcast, and or should I say, welcome to our nightmare.
Welcome. This is going to be fun today. I'm excited.
I'm Chris Sinzak. He's Aaron Camaro. We're your host.
Indeed.
We've got an exciting interview today. We got to recently talk to Dick Wagner, and if you may not know Dick Wagner by name, but you sure as hell know his work.
Yeah, Dick Wagner is a killer guitar player, a rock and roller through and through. He's got an amazing story to tell. If you're a Kiss fan, if you're an Alice Cooper fan, if you're an Aerosmith fan, if you're a rock fan, and if you're a decibel geek like we are, you're going to enjoy this today.
Yeah, this man has quite a bit of rock and roll history, and part of the reason we brought him on here is because Dick has recently put out his own book, and right now it's an ebook. It's going to come out on hardcover in June, but you can get it right now at Amazon. The book is called Not Only Women Bleed, which, as everyone probably knows, Only Women Bleed, one of the biggest songs Alice Cooper ever released, the first song ever about domestic violence, covered by like 27 artists. It's a major song, and but this book, I checked out this book over the past week, and there's so many awesome stories relating to Dick's career. There's drug abuse, there's good times, there's bad times, there's all kinds of crazy sex stories. There's a huge amount of stuff in there, and like my favorite stories are the stuff where you've got different people in pop culture coming together. Alice Cooper was almost all encompassing for this time.
Right. This goes way beyond just being your typical rock autobiography.
Yeah.
It's almost like a snapshot in time.
It is.
Of the people, the places, the times, the things that were going on in these different time periods, be it the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even what he's got going on today. And like I said, we've both been really looking forward to this, to be able to sit down with Dick Wagner. And if you don't know who he is, like Chris said, you know who he is. You've heard his music, but now's a chance to really meet the real Dick Wagner.
Yeah, and before we get to it, I want to thank Mitch LaFon from Brave Words, friend of the show. He's the one that helped hook this interview up. Mitch has known Dick for a number of years. Dick lives in Arizona now. Had lots of great stories, was kind enough to give us some of his time. Before we get started, just want to plug the website, dbgeekshow.blogspot.com. It's doing wonderful. Got great writers. Still looking for a couple more writers to come on staff if you're ever interested. And I guess we'll go ahead and get to it.
I don't think there's anything else to say. I think it's time to talk to Dick Wagner.
Well, let's do it. Well, tell me what it was like being a 17-year-old playing in a band, and then all of a sudden you look over and you're backing up Jerry Lee Lewis.
Wow. Well, the early years for me were, a lot of work, man, learning how to play the guitar. you know, I started playing when I was maybe 16 and a half years old, and which is a little bit late, you know, to become really good. But, you know, I got into it. I loved it. I played it 10 hours a day. Then I put together a band. My first band was four guitar players.
Oh, wow.
You can imagine what that sounded like.
Yeah.
You know, four 17-year-olds who couldn't really play yet. And, man, we were just banging it out, right?
Uh-huh.
And finally I got the notion that, hey, you got to have a bass player and a drummer. So a couple of the guitar players went by the wayside, and I got a drummer and a bass player, and then we had it made. You know, we were playing, you know, small gigs, and there were some places around Michigan where you could, you know, leave town for a weekend and go play, which was really a thrill, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we were doing this television show in Detroit. And the guy said, can you come back next week and back up Jerry Lee Lewis? And, of course, I've been listening to Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, on my record player. Back in those days, you had 45s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, sure, man, I would love to do that. So when we got to Jerry Lee Lewis records and learned the songs and the band practiced, Jerry Lee Lewis comes to town, and we were back on that same television show. And we backed him up on TV live.
Wow.
And he was favorably impressed. And I got to do my first rock and roll guitar solo.
Nice.
Which was real nice. I mean, I don't have any idea what it sounded like, but but I was thrilled, you know. And so he asked us, you know, either through his manager or what, but he asked us if we would back him up on a couple gigs, because he didn't have his band with him. So I said, sure, of course. And the first gig was Ortonville, Michigan, at a roller rink. So we go up to Ortonville, Michigan. We're at the roller rink getting all set up. And then just waiting for Jerry Lee Lewis. And waiting for Jerry Lee Lewis. You know, the kids are coming into place. The place is getting filled up with kids. We go in, we play a few songs, and we're still waiting for Jerry Lee Lewis. And so we go out into the parking lot, and here comes this big green Cadillac, brand new Cadillac. Just comes roaring up. Jerry Lee gets out of the back seat with a bottle of Jack Daniels in his hand and says, "The killer has arrived."
A little fashionably late, even.
Fashionably late and just totally full of himself, but we went in and we played the show. We did a good job, and he was sensational, and I learned a lot from that night. I learned about reaching out and reaching for your audience and bringing them into what you're doing. I mean, instead of just standing there like a dumbass and just playing songs, you gotta bring some emotion to it. And so that was the beginning of learning how to present myself on stage and, you know, getting me ready for the future.
Well, I suppose if you're talking about a performer that puts a lot of personality and emotion into what he was doing, you know, you got to talk about Jerry Lee Lewis as far as somebody to be able to watch this guy and say, hey, you know, this is how you do it. You put some personality into it, and then you connect with your audience.
Right, exactly. And you put on a show for them. You know, you have to entertain. I mean, it's not enough to be just a musician. You have to entertain in some way.
And I'm
you have to captivate your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing that night was probably one of the most responsible evenings that kind of sealed it for you, that this was what you wanted to do with the rest of your life, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, I kind of already knew that. You know, once you go down, like, there was this place called the Greens Pavilion, and we used to play there on a weekend, and we'd be there for three nights. And, you know, once you get down and you start playing music over a weekend, and now you're meeting the girls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the impetus to be there as many weekends as possible. And I guess that sealed my fate, really.
That'll do it. That'll do it every time.
It's always about the chicks.
Man. You know, all these girls, and you're getting some adulation, and you're just a young guy. And I got to say, it was thrilling. It was a real eye-opener, and, you know, just part of growing up. And so I kind of decided, I think that the one time that I really decided that this was what I was going to do all my life was when I went out to a VFW club one night, and there was a band playing there called the Eldorados. And they were up on stage, and they had these two gold top Les Pauls playing through these big Gibson 400 amplifiers, so they were loud and rock and roll. And that was the first time I'd heard a live band.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, oh, my God. And they were wearing these blue satin smoking jackets. And, I mean, they just looked cool. And the guitars were fantastic. I always wanted a gold top Les Paul. And it sounded, to my ears, just orgasmic. I mean, it was just great.
Yeah.
And that sealed my fate for sure that night. Playing with Jerry Lee Lewis actually came, I think, you know, chronologically, it's hard to figure it all out. But they were all in the same period of time, more or less, you know.
Yeah.
I got hooked on it, and that was it.
Well, in regards to your early days, from what I read on the book, and I'm not going to give away what the story is, because this will be a good teaser to get some people to buy the book. If you want to hear a bizarre story, I will say, on behalf of all Nashvillians, we're not all like Frank Denny.
Very funny. Very, very funny. No, I know. I lived in Nashville, like I said. I mean, I had a hard time, in a sense, because there was a resistance. Not, maybe it was to me personally. Maybe I don't know exactly. But you mentioned the good old boy network, and that's true. And there's a rule of thumb in Nashville where you have to live there at least 5 years before they're going to let you in on sessions and all of that kind of stuff. So a lot of musicians move to Nashville, and they end up really just becoming sidemen for country artists going out on the road, because it's so hard to get work in Nashville, unless you're part of the, you know, the main clique of players.
Maybe you were just too much of a rocker for them.
Well, you know, I don't think so, because, you know, a lot of the players who play in Nashville a lot, you know, grew up on rock and roll, so you can hear it in their playing, especially the guitar players.
Yeah.
There's a weird kind of, it's almost like a secret handshake type of society down here. I mean, it's been that way for a while. It has opened up a bit over the last few years, but the time when you were down here in the early 90s, it was really bad for that kind of thing.
Yes, it was. Very, very difficult. But I love living in Nashville. I mean, it's a beautiful town and nice people. And, you know, I did meet a few guys that I could write songs with. And that's a little more open kind of thing.
Well, and I suppose, you know, as you mentioned in the book, and you already know that Bob Ezra now works out of here and did the new Alice record there, and you know, here in Nashville.
Yes, he does. And I spoke to him not too long ago, and I asked him about Nashville, how he was doing in Nashville. He said it's a really tough city. And it's really hard to get work there. Most of his work comes from out of town into Nashville, and he records them.
Wow.
But as far as finding talent or having a big headway there in Nashville, he's experiencing the same thing to a certain degree.
That is,
of course, Ezra, you know, he's more famous, and he's bigger in the industry than I ever was, so he probably has more success than I had.
It's crazy
but
that
But he did complain about it, too. It's sort of the same thing. It doesn't seem to end.
Yeah, it's wild that somebody of his stature with his name would have any trouble getting artists to come in.
Well, you know, Al Cooper from Blood, Sweat, Tears, he warned me before I went to Nashville, because I spoke to him just before I moved there. He said, don't expect to work here. What are you talking about? I mean, I've been playing sessions and doing the records for years. He said, there's no work here. You're going to have to go outside. So he warned me before. I guess it affected everybody to some degree.
Yeah. Well,
but you wouldn't listen to him.
No, I wouldn't. Besides, I had a girlfriend who had left me, and she'd moved to Nashville, and I was determined to get her back.
Wow.
So part of my reason going to Nashville was for her.
That's always
See,
a woman.
Once again, women steering your fate for
God.
You out there.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it? It's terrible.
Oh, you should read the book.
You need to read the book, really. Yeah. It's a philosophical trip.
It is. You have lived quite a life, sir, and we definitely want to talk about some of it. I hope you don't mind me skipping ahead just a tad, because...
you handle it any way you want.
All right.
Sweet.
Okay? Well, I want to talk about some of the stories that really got me. One of my favorite things from the book was, I think it was right when you first met Alice, you noticed his kind of unorthodox workout routine, where he would drink a beer and then do 25 sit-ups.
Right, exactly.
I got to imagine, for Alice Cooper, that's a lot of sit-ups at that time.
Well, he was doing them all day long. Yeah. He was doing them all day long. I mean, Alice, in the peak of his alcoholism, I mean, I stayed at his house a few times, and I'd come out in the morning, and he was still sitting in front of the TV. I don't think he ever went to bed. He just fell asleep in the chair.
Uh-huh.
And he'd wake up in the morning, and the first thing he would do is pour himself a big, 10-ounce tumbler of whiskey.
Oof.
And he started drinking the whiskey, and then he'd shift over to beer, and then he'd drink beer all day long until, you know, into the evening he might start sipping whiskey again. But
oh, wow.
It was pathetic. I mean, I loved Alice. He's a great guy. I was very frightened for him, in the sense that the amount he was drinking.
What was the peak years for that era for him? Was it the early 80s?
Geez, let me think for a second, because I, you know, to me, those decades.
Well, I know you guys did the Da Da album, and then he took quite a long break after that. I didn't know if that was during the period that he hit the rock, hit rock bottom.
He had gone into rehab for alcoholism, probably around 1979. Okay, then he came back out, and then the Da Da album we did in 1983, I think.
Yeah.
So he had gotten free of alcohol, and then he got into drug abuse. And then he and I went to Toronto. We made the Da Da album, and we were doing nothing but drinking all the time there. So he got back into his alcoholism. And after Da Da, I think he went back into rehab, and he's been clean ever since.
Yeah, we didn't hear from him for a few years there. It's amazing how on the level and clean he is now. I mean, because it's like, and I was talking to Aaron before we got on the phone with you. One thing, when you think back into this period of time, a lot of people here, a lot of general hard rock and metal fans, they know of Alice Cooper more from, if it's the older stuff, they know School's Out, they know 18, and then the newer stuff, they know, you know, Poison and those songs that are more of the, like, the straight-ahead three-chord type rock numbers. But what I think is amazing is the stuff that you did when you were with him, because there was so much experimentation going on, and like a lot of people try to put Alice Cooper and Kiss in the same ballpark, and I'm like, aside from makeup, especially during the era you were with him,
and theatrics, but
musically they couldn't have been any different, I don't think.
No, you're right about the music situation. It is actually because I got involved with them. Mm-hmm. I mean, my writing is, you know, just a different animal than the three chord metal stuff.
Right.
I mean, I could write a rock riff, you know, I was pretty good at it too, but I never really got into the really thrash or really heavy metal stuff.
Right. But the musicality of what you brought to the table was it's pretty stunning. I mean, because if you listen to a lot of the rock and roll stuff from around that time, there was really nothing like what you guys were doing. I mean, it was very unique.
You're right, and I'm glad you noticed that. But I've always believed in the song. You know, since I first started writing songs, I realized that the song is the most important part of the whole thing, the whole package.
Right.
You know, you can have different singers, you can have different bands playing. But if you don't have the song, then you got nothing.
That's true.
I've always believed in, you know, the essence of what hit music is, or what popular music is based on songs. I tried to become a really good songwriter. I think I've done pretty well with it, but...
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd say.
So I applied it. You know, I applied it in every case, whether I was doing a country record for somebody or whether I was doing an Alice Cooper record or whatever. You know, I'd bring songs in.
No, I don't want to hear that Nickelback song again.
My asshole hurts. Got so bad, I gotta go to the hospital.
Really? This is a Decibel Geek Podcast.
Hi, this is Rick Allen's left arm. You're listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast.
I mean, you definitely can. You can tell the difference before and after that you became involved. And you've been involved with a lot of different bands, from Kiss and Aerosmith. I mean, you worked on the song Train Kept a Rollin', is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, how did that work? Yeah. I mean, the story that I've heard was that, you know, you guys were never credited on the album for playing on that, but that Steven Tyler actually wanted you guys to do it. I mean, how did that all play out?
I was sitting in my apartment in the Plaza Hotel in New York City. I was living high on the hog there for a while. And I got a call from Jack Douglas to come over and play some guitar on an Aerosmith album. And so I just got my guitar and went down to the studio. And it was like 10 o'clock at night. And they laid down tracks. They had tracks, you know, with rough vocals, or maybe they didn't even have vocals yet. I don't remember for sure. But it was like, okay, this is where we want you to play in this section. And then you just get your sound, and, you know, play, and just let it go. And happened to come up with some stuff that was they really loved, and they weren't able to actually play it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Joe Perry and Brad Whitford are, you know, they're good guys. They're good guitar players, really good. Especially now, they've really gotten great. But at that time, they just weren't capable of playing on the level that me and Steve Hunter, we were the two guys who did these records most of the time. Mm-hmm. They couldn't play on that level exactly, so we'd be called in, you know, like Gunslingers, we'd be called in to do something that had to, that the guys in the band really actually couldn't do.
Right.
And, you know, the producer's sitting there, and he's going, oh, I imagine this, and when he imagines something and the band can't play it, it's frustrating. You know?
Right, I'm sure.
So they called me in this particular night, and I played what I played, and I played on like four songs on that album. You know, the rest is history.
Right.
I mean, they did not credit me or Steve. It's okay. I mean, they were trying to keep a mystique about them at the time.
Right.
You know, and so you can't blame them in a way. I mean, it's kind of petty, but in the end, I went to see Aerosmith, and I took my sons down to a concert of Aerosmith at the San Antonio Convention Center. And I was backstage saying hello to the guys, and Steven Tyler goes over in front of all these people and puts his arm around me and says, this is a guy that sold us 3 million records.
Nice.
That's awesome.
You know, it was like the first time that they had ever admitted that I had something to do with it. And it was very, of course, in front of my sons.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that must have been very cool.
Very special that way. So I've always held a soft spot for Steven Tyler in my heart because that was such a nice thing to do. He didn't have to do it. I mean, it was already non-credited for years.
Right.
And, you know, what was I going to do, stand on the rooftops and shout, I played that solo?
Right.
Some people would. You
don't do that. I just let it go.
So yeah. As a gunslinger, a guy that has a guitar and will travel, when you show up at a studio, for example, like this, you know, is there bad feelings from the guitar players that are already there that can't cut it at the moment, you know, that they bring you in? You know, do these guys look at you like, you know, who's this asshole and what are you doing here and why are you trying to play my solo? I mean, I got to imagine sometimes there's probably bad feelings like that. I mean, was that the case here?
Well, you know something? I don't know. I mean, when I arrived at 10 o'clock at night at the record plant to do the solos, they weren't there, the guys in the band.
Mm-hmm.
Same when I played on Kiss.
Yeah. Were they at the card game with Ace Frehley?
Ace Frehley wasn't there.
Yeah.
He's the one, but I did hear that Ace Frehley is the one who really bitched and complained
mm-hmm.
and told them they dare not credit me for the stuff that I did.
Right.
And they did, if I get a spot where I can play and it, and I do a good job, I mean, that's what I'm supposed to do, right?
Right.
So I go in and I play the best that I can play and be as inventive as I can be and try to, you know, fit into and flow with the song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to go in there and put something in there that looks like a, you know, a big red stripe through a, you know, a classical painting.
Right.
You want to go in and do something that fits exactly what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and that solo on Sweet Pain definitely fit because for years I didn't know it was an Ace. I mean, it sounded enough like him, but at the same time, once I found out it was you, I can definitely hear a different feel in that. And I will say, in fairness to Ace, I have heard him quote saying it wasn't, I don't know necessarily that he was angry at you. I think he was more angry at Paul, Gene, and Bob for not telling him until the album was already out or something.
Well, that may be. I mean, I don't know, because I just went in and did my thing, and I didn't know anything about Ace Frehley, why he wasn't there, why he wasn't doing it.
Right.
You know, they hired me to do something, and I came in and did it. And so it wasn't like I, you know, conned my way into, you know, cutting Ace Frehley out of the deal.
Right.
Well, anything like that. It was like they just hired me to come in and play.
Right.
And that's what a hired gun does.
So I did. And if Ace didn't like it, well, that's okay. You know, I wouldn't like it if it were my band.
Yeah. Well, how does...
So I don't blame him in a sense, but...
Yeah.
You know, he should have been more on top of it so that I wasn't needed.
That's it.
Well, and how does that relate to your appearance on Kiss's Revenge album when you did... I think it was the Every Time I Look at You solo. Did
right.
What was the circumstances that led you to that instead of Bruce Kulick playing that solo?
Well, we were playing. I was doing some cutting some demos at Track. I think it was Track Studio in Studio B, and Kiss had come in to Studio A, and Paul Stanley came over and was listening to the stuff that I was doing, and he said, "Hey, I got a song that I want you to play on." And so I just went over to the other studio and played it. Mm-hmm. You know? Paul and I got to be friends, and we used to hang out a bit, and we even tried to do some writing together. There was never enough time, and Paul was so busy all that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was very hard for us to sit down and really actually come up with songs and demos. But we did spend a lot of time together, and when he knew I was in the studio, he came over to say hello to me. And it just happened that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bruce Kulick, he wasn't there. I don't know why he wasn't there. It isn't like I did it because he couldn't.
Right.
It was because of the circumstance. I was there, and he wasn't, and Paul asked me.
Yeah.
I think maybe it was kind of like, for old time's sake, let's go play one together.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that could be part of it, because we were friends.
Oh, that and working with
course,
Bob.
Ezra was there, and he's my friend, and so it just worked, you know.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Kiss, I was going to ask you, like I'd mentioned earlier, how different the musical types of sounds that you guys and Kiss had in the 70s. What was Alice and you and even your opinion of Kiss at that era when they were blowing up? Was Alice happy for them, or was he thinking, oh, these guys are ripping me off?
Well, I would say there's a little bit of that.
Really?
That's what you got to look at it as competition,
you know,
too.
I think Alice kind of had the market, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he was the innovator. He's the one that made it happen. And all of a sudden, this band is doing the same kind of makeup kind of idea,
mm-hmm.
and just going way over the top with it, and becoming even bigger than he was. And I don't think he liked it in particular. I don't think he held any resentment or anything afterward. But I'm sure during that time, it was affecting him to a certain degree.
Right. Have you heard the story about when I think it was before you joined the band. It was when Kiss was first starting out, and Alice was there for their first show, and after the show, Alice looked at Gene and said, "What you guys need is a gimmick."
That sounds like Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly his kind of gimmick.
But yeah, I was going to mention that, you know, Kiss definitely has not hidden their admiration for Alice, because I know that a big moment for them coming up with the makeup idea was they went and saw Alice's band play at Madison Square Garden, and after the show, they were like, well, what would it be like if we were four Alice Coopers? So, I mean, they definitely got...
That.
Oh, yeah. Like two of them, I think it was Ace and Paul, ran right to the front of the stage. They were just enamored with what Alice was doing, and took their influence heavily from him.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, that's right, rightfully so. You know?
Yeah.
We went one night to Madison Square Garden, the four of us, and Alice Cooper was performing. Paul and Ace and I ran all the way down to the front to just stare at him.
We were kind of like kneeling down, trying to, you know, get as close as we could. And I remember watching the show, and we were just blown away.
And that's what probed the idea of, what if we had four Alice Coopers, but different types of makeup?
Well, sure, everything comes from somewhere.
Yeah, and Alice Cooper was definitely the innovator. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he really created, you know, the theatrics in rock the way that we see it today.
It doesn't matter, you know, how many, you know, doll heads you chop off, or how many snakes you have on stage, or how high you can blow the fire or spit the blood. Like you said earlier, it comes down to the song, you know, and all these things don't really matter if you don't have the song.
This I definitely agree with you, and I think that that's really the truth. You have to have songs. If you don't have songs, what are people going to remember?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they will remember the show, but that's a fleeting memory.
Right.
You know, the songs remain.
Well, speaking of speaking of the show, at the time, did you, because I know, I'm sure you were into the theatrics, especially, you know, working with Lou Reed before Alice, did it ever get to the point where you're like, well, why are we doing so much show stuff? Why aren't we focusing more on music?
Not at all.
Not at all?
Not at all, because my bands early on, like the Boss Men, we did a lot of different kind of theatrical things. We weren't like Alice, but we did all these skits and play acting stuff. I was always into theatrics, so it felt natural to me.
Putting an end to ugly rumors, Gene Simmons does not have a cow's tongue. You're listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast. Listen to the Decibel Geek podcast on your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and WebOS phones with Stitcher. Stitcher's smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
I don't want to share too much from the book because I want people to buy the book, but one of the probably my favorite story in the book, if you could just share a quick summation of it, was the story about you guys with Alice's band staying at the Riot House or the Continental Hyatt House and the two limos. Can you share that story with us?
I will. I went down one night from my hotel room at Continental Hyatt House in L.A. to go out somewhere. I walked out the front door, and there's these two limousines parked in front, and the one in the back was trying to get out and get around the other one, and it was they were parked too close. And so some of the guys in the limo in the back get out and start mouthing off at the limousine driver in front, and it was Robert Plant who was mouthing off mainly, you know, Led Zeppelin, okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Zeppelin's in the rear limousine, and the limousine driver, as cool as hell, says, "Just talk to my boss." And he pointed over at the doorway, and coming out the front door was George Foreman.
And this was when...
Champion of the world.
Yeah, I don't see any of the guys from Zeppelin lipping off to old George Foreman.
Yeah, exactly right. And so they kind of cooled their heels and got out of there without any kind of confrontation. But George Foreman was ready to...
Well, he'd have tore their heads off.
I imagine he was ready to pop him in the mouth. But,
yeah,
of course, he's a professional boxer. He wouldn't do that.
Right. Yeah.
But this was before...
It was just interesting to see the confrontation between the heavyweight champion of the world and... You know, the biggest rock and roll band.
Wow.
It's such a crossroads of pop funny, culture. Yeah. Yeah, I love that story.
That's awesome.
And then,
yeah, it was great. It was I was just standing there watching this go down. I'm going, wow, this is funny.
Yeah, well, and one
welcome
of,
to L.A.
One of the things,
right.
One of the things you do in the book that's what I love the most is it's quite a snapshot of pop culture from that period, because like the other story about when you guys wrote the song "How You Gonna See Me Now" on the From the Inside album, you've got Bernie Taupin writing the lyrics with Alice, and then you writing the music, and then Toto coming in to cut the track, and then the track is produced by David Foster, and it's just like that is the strangest combination of people I've ever heard of for one song.
Well, it was a strange combination in that sense, but you know, I mean, they're all this is great players and great musicians and great musical minds all, you know, gelling together there, and it really worked out. I didn't know David Foster that well,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't sure if his arrangement was going to, his production was going to be as good as, let's say, what Bob Ezrin had done.
Right.
And in the end, it had its own charm and its own, it became a hit, so
yeah.
What can you say? I mean, it was great. And the guys in Toto, Steve Lukather and I were in there playing guitars together. I loved that. That was fun.
Yeah, he's just a monster on guitar.
Oh, well, he's a great guitar player, and... And as a band, Toto was like, you know, as tight as you could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a great studio band, you know, on their own, but also for doing sessions for other people.
Right.
Well, that's a funny thing about that, though, is on the surface of that, you wouldn't think of, you know, the Alice Cooper band and Toto, you know, on the surface, not knowing nothing about their studio musicianship or anything, wouldn't have anything to do with each other. It just seems weird.
But nothing at all, right? Nothing at all. That was David Foster. I mean, Toto, they were his friends, not Alice's.
Uh-huh.
And David was the producer, so he had the right to, you know, at least set it up, and Alice happened to love it. And Bernie Taupin, he had become friends before I came to L.A. and to do this album. And I got to L.A., I went to Alice's house, as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Got introduced to Bernie Taupin, who was, you know, like, I idolized him. I thought he was such a great lyricist. So here I'm standing there with Alice Cooper and Bernie Taupin, two of the best lyricists in the whole business.
Wow.
And they hand me sheets of paper and say, "Here, we want you to write the music. Here are the lyrics. We've already written them."
Nice. Now, that's got to be kind of a tall order.
The first song they handed me was "How Are You Gonna See Me Now," which was the most natural flow lyric. And I wrote the song in about 20 minutes. And that's it. You know, just one of those things that just flows from you.
I think you must have just a great ear for music to be able to come in, to be called into a studio, and they say, here's the song, you know, lay your part to it. And, like, for example, with Sweet Pain from Kiss, you know, to come in and, I mean, was that the first time you'd ever heard the song, and then you got just a little bit of time fit it in?
Yeah.
And then, you know, so that says a lot about your ear for music, too, to be able to hear this song and say, here's what fits, you know. And it, like you say, you don't put the big red stripe across the beautiful portrait, but you make it so it's like Chris
seamless.
Said, you don't, yeah, it's seamless. You don't know it's not Ace Frehley, but yet it sounds like a Kiss song, you know, and so that's a hell of a talent right there.
Well, thank you. I like to, I mean, I try to in any situation. My first rule is learn the song, know the song. Mm-hmm. I mean, so as soon as they started playing it for me, I just, you know, grasp it because I understand how chord progressions work naturally. And so I can kind of feel what the song is and where it's going. And then listening to those basic tracks, you know, you get ideas. And all you have to do is commit those ideas to mind and work them out on the guitar and play it. And if you've got the touch, you know, it takes a certain touch to play those soaring kind of leads, you mm-hmm. know.
Well, and I gotta just say, after really looking through, I took a pretty good look through the book over this past week. I'm still reading parts of it, but what I've noticed, though, is it's just like, if I try to put myself in your shoes, I mean, it must have been almost quite a thing to look back at in hindsight when you finished this book, looking back on all of this stuff to, you know, see where you, how, you know, how far you went. And, I mean, it's quite an amazing life. I mean, you've honestly lived like the life of what 10 men could even hope to live.
That's a good way to put it.
You have. I mean,
after I read the book and it was finished finally, you know, and I thought it was really good. I mean, I thought that the stories were told with enough humor so that it wasn't a serious self-help book or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, it gets into a lot of psychological things, and especially about drug addiction and everything. But I tried to lend the humor of the moment to it, you know, when I could, and, mm-hmm. you know, to take the edge off a little bit and make it readable by pretty much anybody. It's an e-book. It's coming out in hardcover, though.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's coming out in June in hardcover, and I'm also including two CDs in the book. I'm having it manufactured that way as a bonus, you know, so that it's a way for me to put some of my music out there also at the same time.
Is it unreleased and stuff?
It's my record Full Meltdown. The last record I released was called Full Meltdown.
Oh, okay.
And it's tracks that I discovered. Well, it's kind of a story in itself. I got a call from somebody at Rhino Records, and they told me they had a tape of like 8 or 9 of my songs, and they were going to release it on this Wounded Bird label. And they sent me a copy of the stuff, and I listened to it, and I remembered that I had recorded these songs, written them and recorded them in 1979 up in Massachusetts at a place called Longview Farm. It's a farm, but it was also a recording studio, right? I owned these tapes, and I had forgotten about them.
Wow. So this would be the first time you'd heard it in a long time?
Somehow Atlantic Records got them, and Atlantic Records, you know, gave them over to Rhino Records. And just by chance, this guy called me, and I said, no, you can't release that. They're mine. They belong to me.
Right.
And so I want them back, and I'm going to release them myself, which is what I did.
Good.
So I'm going to take that CD, which I think is a great rock and roll CD, and put it in my book. Put it inside the book. So when you buy the book, hardcover, you also get a couple of CDs in there. So it's music and my stories at the same time, and maybe that's my legacy, and that's it.
I think that's a great way to do it.
That book.
Yeah, definitely want to
be selling it. I'm going to be selling the book not only on the internet and stuff, but I'm going to be selling it at my merchandise table. I'm going to go out on tour this summer and in the fall. And I'll be selling my book and playing my music, and hey, life couldn't be any better.
That sounds pretty sweet. When you're out playing on tour, like now, you know, when you're out playing shows, what kind of fans are you getting showing up? Are you getting Kiss fans? Are you getting Alice Cooper fans? All of the above? Your solo stuff? Who's showing up at your shows?
Oh man, it's a cross section. I mean, it is Alice Cooper fans, and it is Kiss fans. It's anything that I've done. They're my fans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my my audience is so far, since I've gone back out on the road, you know, they're just like, they're there to see me. They come with armfuls of albums, you know, for me to autograph.
And, well, I bet you're on just about everything.
Yeah, it's just crazy. You know, people will bring 10 albums.
Wow.
Want me to sign every one of them. You know, it'll be a Kiss and a couple of Alice Cooper and a this and a that. You know, my discography, you can look it up on my website, and you can see how many albums I have played on. It's WagnerMusic.com, by the way.
And is that the best place to go to pick up the book until it comes out on hardcover?
Actually, the best place probably to get the book is Amazon.com.
Okay. Okay.
So when is the book available then, with the CDs and the music and everything? That's what I want to know.
Well, it's in production right now. It's going to be available in June.
Excellent.
Right now the date is June 25th. I don't know if that'll be off by a few days, but June 25th will be the official hardcover plus bonus CDs release of my book.
If you're into the Kendall thing and you're into reading books online, definitely want to go to Amazon and get this book. It's an excellent read. The rest of us, well, we're just going to have to hold out till June. And, you know, even if you do get it on the Kindle and read it as an e-book, you want to hang out, you want to get the hard copy version, because if you're like me, you like to have that book in your hand and have that
and
music also,
yeah.
You know, so definitely be watching for that. You're going to have updates and everything on your website?
I will say this, too. Anybody who buys the hardcover book in June with a request, if they request it, I will personalize a signed book for them. So
awesome.
Nice.
Even if it's by them buying it from me and I send it to them personally autographed. Wonderful. I mean, I want it to be special in some way to everyone who buys it, you know, aside from just reading it.
Right. Well, that sounds like a great package, Dick.
Yeah.
And we will definitely, we're going to promote it here on the e-version, and we'll promote it in June when it comes out, if you like, and try to get the word out for you.
Heck yeah, we
You're
will.
You're good men. I appreciate you guys. I really do. I thank you very much.
Oh, no problem at all. And if you ever might come back to Nashville sometime, look us up, and we'll have you on again.
Okay, we'll do that.
Heck yeah. We don't have a five-year waiting list. You can hang out with us anytime.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Well, it's been pretty sweet, informative, and rocking to be able to hang out and talk to Dick Wagner today. So many great stories, and like I said, if you really want to delve into this, and I highly recommend you do, check out Dick Wagner's book, Not Only Women Bleed. I mean, it's so much more than just a rock and roll cautionary tale. You know, it's the highs, the lows, the women, the booze, the drugs, all that stuff. Filling in for Ace Frehley, filling in for Joe Perry. You know, it's just through and through. It's an amazing book. And like I said, if you're like me, you want the hard copy with the music, that's coming up in June. You know, we're going to keep you updated on that.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Wagner's website, what was it one more time?
WagnerMusic.com.
That's it. So keep checking in with him at that website. Keep checking in with us here at the Decibel Geek podcast. You know, it's, of course, you know the website there. We say it every single time. One more time, what the hell? www.dbgeekshow.blogspot.com.
Jinx.
Yeah, thanks for that. We've got so much stuff coming up. I mean, this has been a real treat today to sit down with Dick Wagner. Now we're going to have some real fun, because we've got some great stuff lined up for the next couple of weeks.
And we even have more interviews coming on the way, too.
Yeah, we're kind of planning ahead, and we're doing it for you guys, so we hope you like it.
We may have to hire a publicist.
Pretty soon we're going to have to. I mean, seriously, we got people coming to us wanting to have us interview them,
yeah.
You know, which is kind of a trip for us, you know, which is cool. But, you know, at the same time, you know, everyone says, hey, you know, how about next week? Well, you know, we've got this guy next week, and we've got that plan for next week. What about the week after that?
Yeah.
Well, we've kind of got this that week and this that week. So if you're on our list and you've been talking to us, you know, we're not trying to be jerks. We're not trying to put you off. We're just trying to fit everything in and give everybody their proper due and their proper time.
So I guess we're good for today, right?
Yeah, it's too much sometimes. But, yeah, we're going to wrap it up today and prepare for next week.
Yeah, we will see you folks next week, and have a good one.
Remember to check us out at dbgeekshow.blogspot.com, facebook.com/decibelgeek, and Twitter at decibelgeekpod. Also available for free on iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
Hey, Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.